start again. I'm Ms. Mary Lou Breslin. I'm a senior policy advisor with Disability Rights, Education, and Defense Fund at the International Law and Policy Center. It's been around for over 3 decades. We have an office in the San Francisco area and one in Washington. And our focus has really been on disability and civil rights issues for many years. The last 8 or 10 years, we've been working in the healthcare policy area, spurred largely by the experience of our colleagues and friends and people that we are very close to who have experienced very significant problems accessing healthcare. Kids with disabilities, young adults with disabilities, seniors with disabilities. So our focus has been trying to identify the pressure points where it might be possible to have some influence over the conduct of healthcare and the delivery of healthcare. We had no experience in the Medicare, Medicaid area until the last few years, and really backed into it when California was awarded an 1115 waiver to move up to 400,000 people with disabilities and seniors into mandatory managed care for fee-for-service. And it sort of collided, that process collided with our interest in ensuring that people have access to not only physical and programmatic access to health care, but also we understood the nature of relationships between people with disabilities and their providers, a kind of intricate network that's often set up that serves people with disabilities in important ways that might be lost in these kinds of transitions. So we became very involved in working with the state, working with groups around the state to try to influence the rollout of this waiver process. And in the course of being involved with it, we learned a lot about Medicaid and a lot that has helped inform the work that we've been doing over the last year and a half or so on the duals rollout. So the experience in California, the mandatory enrollment of people with disabilities and seniors into managed care in California has really been a roadmap for the ACA expansion and the duals demonstration. And it sets the stage for the California duals demonstration that I think, as everybody has mentioned here, is likely to affect as many as 560,000 people in 8 counties. Now, we're focusing on California because we're here, and because we thought that the California duals demonstration was likely to follow the demonstration, the approval by CMS, follow what's been going on in Massachusetts. And that, for many of you who are here from Massachusetts, you guys did a great job for getting your demonstration off the ground. Your advocacy work was extraordinary. We learned from you. We wish we had done as well as you did. We expected California to be the second rollout. That has turned out not to be the case. Washington State has come in, I think, in what?
Last week.
Last week and Wednesday or Thursday of last week. Okay, let me just say a little bit about the sort of profile of people with disabilities and seniors in California. 240,000 seniors and people with disabilities were moved from their fee-for-service providers into managed care between June 2011 and May 2012. 140,000 more seniors and people with disabilities were already in managed care, but at that point, they lost their opt-out rights. So it wasn't possible then for them to move back into fee-for-service if they elected or chose to do so. The combined waiver program in California includes the mandatory enrollment of seniors and people with disabilities into managed care, but also some other provisions that allow cost savings and additional cost funding. Is expected to save about $2.1 billion over 5 years. And both Gina and Kevin talked about the sort of how realistic is it to expect these kinds of savings and where those numbers come from and what's the implication of calculating those costs up front versus waiting to see if you actually have any savings. Okay, there are a number of potential concerns with the 1115 waiver, which very much mimic what has gone, what Kevin and Gene talked about in terms of what is expected with the duals demonstration. This includes, for example, adequacy of primary care physician networks, specialty provider networks, involvement of key providers such as large medical centers and teaching hospitals. We know, for example, that in Los Angeles, one of the major medical teaching hospitals did not want to participate for a variety of reasons having to do with cost reimbursement and just the concern about the process of mechanically being involved. Another potential concern is that managed care organizations are completely unfamiliar with the clinical needs of people with disabilities, as both Gene and Kevin mentioned. And one of the major concerns that everyone had before this waiver rollout happened was a concern about disruptions in continuity of care. And in fact, that's proven to be one of the sort of major concerns that has been identified as it actually has been rolling out. Other concerns are the cost savings over care needs in a capitated risk-based system. Managed care organizations, the concern is that they will reduce provider rates, they may deny service, there may be an interrelationship between those two, which is going to result in inadequate care. Inadequate quality measures is a very big concern, both for the 1115 waiver and also particularly for the duals for a wide variety of reasons. Consumer protections is an issue that Kevin, of course, just talked about at some point. And, of course, one of our big concerns is the lack of physical and programmatic accessibility of provider facilities and services. This is an ongoing, unresolved issue, and from our standpoint, this is a civil rights issue, not only because those requirements are key to appropriate health care for people with disabilities and seniors, but because, oh, by the way, it's required by the Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the 1990 Rehabilitation Act. So we have the intersection of disability rights, legal requirements with sort of good sense, common sense care and the services that people require in order to stay healthy or become healthy again. Okay, let me just give you a quick illustration here. I just want to make note of the fact that there are three people in the room today who are deeply involved in developing this study. The slide that you see here involves results from a study that Dredf did in collaboration with the School of Social Work at Syracuse University, and some others in the audience, and I'm including Megan Pernahan. Thank you very much for having been involved with this study. And June Kales was absolutely instrumental in getting four big health plans in California to voluntarily collect accessibility data on their primary care physician offices. Without June's advocacy and Nancy's analysis, we would not have this data. But we were able to get the data from the five health plans that had been collected information about their primary care docs' offices. It involves 2,389 primary care facilities in the state. And of those over 2,000 primary care offices, only 3.6% had accessible weight scales, and only 8.4% had adjustable exam tables. And I provide that data only, and I don't think this is any surprise to, as a surprise to anybody in this room, but as a just a little bit of a warning about the kinds of problems that people with disabilities with mobility and physical disabilities and other kinds of disabilities that would prevent them from being able to use this standard equipment would be experiencing, but because it stands for the lack of programmatic accessibility in healthcare. Not only are these problems real, these two problems real problems, but they stand for other problems that are very evident, including cultural competency, the ability of providers to accommodate appropriately people who need sign language interpreters or materials in alternative formats or additional time for examinations, and who really have no training in disability literacy and make mistakes as a result of that. So we see these kinds of problems really compounding the concerns of the 1115 waiver folks as well as the dually eligible folks. Okay, I'd like to just give just a little bit of feedback about the experience of the 1115 waiver in terms of what we sort of know has happened. And this is kind of bringing the fairly theoretical conversation somewhat down to the ground. And this is, of course, this is new information in that the waiver has been rolling out over the last year. The 200 and whatever number, 1,000 people have been enrolled in, mandatorily enrolled in managed care. And our ability to look at what has gone on with those people is just beginning to take place. The California Healthcare Foundation, which has been really terrific in trying to stay on top of what's been going on in California with this program, has recently produced two reports. First look was published in August 2012, and it concerns the mandatory enrollment in the managed care and makes a series of observations and recommendations. And the second report, published a couple of months later in October, entitled "Bridge to Reform: California's Medicaid Section 1115 Waiver," adds to what the findings in the first report. These reports are basically information collected from stakeholders about how well things went with the waiver implementation. And you can just imagine that there were a number of challenges with the waiver. These challenges sort of came pretty closely to the concerns that both Kevin and Gene laid out in their presentation. The individuals who were, in fact, mandatorily enrolled reported that there was inadequate outreach to them. There was a very confusing medical exemption policy. There was difficulty maintaining continuity of care. This is a particularly big problem here. There was improper enrollment. There was difficulty sharing beneficiary claims data from the perspective of the plans. There were many challenges with rate setting, as you can even just envision. And there were performance measures that there were no performance measures, so there was no way to base what went on with something that they could compare that to or with. So these challenges are not a surprise, but are definitely beginning to be better understood as a result of the 1115 waiver. Let me just say a little bit about each of these. The inadequate outreach problem cut across a whole range of areas, including difficulty understanding written notices on the part of the beneficiaries, inadequate individual counseling and support by telephone, which was promised and yet not provided, not really a big surprise. June and I actually did quite a bit of training with the health plans in California to try to provide a bit of a ramp up for them so that they would know what they might be facing. And yet, of course, these kinds of problems took place irrespective of the fact that we did training with them. There was plan inability to answer beneficiary questions, which is not a surprise in the least. There was much confusion regarding the medical exemption policy. This was a very important element in this waiver because it was a way for people to be able to stay with their current providers for a 12-month period, taking into account that people may have ongoing medical needs that really could not be dealt with appropriately if they were placed into provider networks where nobody knew anything about them. There were denials even when the medical exemption criteria were met. There were delays of more than 90 days in many cases. There was confusion over what should or could be resolved at the plan level versus the actual need for an exemption. Okay, there was in terms of difficulty maintaining continuity of care, this is, if this goes down for the third time, this is one of the big deals. The plans were not prepared for the prevalence of the complex conditions of the folks that they were seeing, particularly people with mental health problems, homelessness, and people with developmental disabilities presented very significant issues for the plans. Improper enrollment specifically dealt with dually eligible folks being defaulted into managed care by mistake when they should have been exempt. Okay, the issue of difficulty sharing beneficiary claims data is also, as could have been expected, there was lack of timely data from the California Department of Healthcare Services that was needed in order for the plans to be able to contact the beneficiaries, to be able to determine what their needs were. Therefore, the inadequate claims data resulted in a sort of a cascade of problems. There was challenges with rate setting, and there was an apparent lack of data on the population being moved to managed care that hindered accurate rate setting. And this presumably is a function of the state having data on the categories of people who were on Social Security, Supplemental Security Income, SSI, which is not doesn't drill down significantly enough for them to know what they need to know in order to rate set appropriately. Performance measures were a very big deal. There were no performance goals established at the outset, so it was impossible to evaluate the transition's effectiveness. Okay, let me just spend a couple minutes here on sort of taking it really down to the ground and give you a couple of examples of folks who actually were transitioned and who had some pretty serious problems. Marta, who is, let me just say that these are two examples that were provided by the Neighborhood Legal Services Office in Los Angeles, who represented both of these folks trying to improve what happened to them in this process. Marta is a 61-year-old living in LA. She has rheumatoid arthritis. She uses a wheelchair. She needs very significant assistance with all of her activities of daily living. In fact, her husband provides most of her personal assistance services, including dressing, bathing, toileting, feeding, and so on. She needs regular cortisone injections to help with her rheumatoid arthritis. She had very significant difficulties obtaining a medical exemption in the process, and eventually she was denied her request for a medical exemption. Her arthritis doctor agreed to try to continue to provide continuity of care, which was a very good thing that this person was willing to try to continue to help the beneficiary. However, the medical exemption eventually was approved. However, the guarantee of 12 months was not approved. She was granted a three-month extension, which did not really help in terms of her specific needs. She needs these cortisone shots at least twice per three-month period, and often monthly, and yet the plan only authorized her for one-office visit in 3 months. Her doctor saw her in February and set another appointment for March, but according to the plan correspondence, the attorneys were able to acquire, the plan would not pay for these two visits. In order to address the pain that she was experiencing, that was documented by her physician over the course of many years, just that she would have to pay out of pocket and could not get the plan's help again until late May. The Neighborhood Legal Services filed a grievance against the plan's decision. They asked for an expedited grievance. The plan said no. They said they would get back to the beneficiary within 5 days, and a decision within 30 days. This obviously was too late for her to be able to be on her treatment schedule. So this is just one example of the kinds of problems that you can see coming up and that will continue to come up for other folks. Let me just give you one other example. Marlena lives in Santa Monica. She's a 62-year-old, and she's an SSI beneficiary. She has thyroid cancer, and she had severe damage from radiation, which requires treatment by an endocrinologist, a neurologist, and an oncologist. Her symptoms are that she has spasms throughout her whole body, her feet, experience burning sensations as she drops things, and really difficulty in walking. She was enrolled in a plan in September after the doctors at her clinic, who don't take managed care, tried to stay with her through the continuity of care process and through the request for medical exemption, both of which were unsuccessful. By the time she came to the Neighborhood Legal Services, she was in the plan, struggling to get connected to doctors for almost 6 months without any care. She had not been able to see any of the three specialists she was referred to by the plan over a six-month period. For one specialist, she was assigned to a provider in Pomona, requiring a 100-mile round-trip drive, even though she doesn't drive and doesn't have a car. The plan's response was that they offer transportation, but not in this case, because the transportation is only good for 25 miles. For another provider, she was referred to an endocrinologist, waited for an appointment, and when she got there, she learned that the provider was an obstetrician, gynecologist, and not a practicing endocrinologist. So the plan's response was that it was an appropriate referral because some providers had dual licenses. Even though it acknowledged this provider didn't have a dual license. Okay. Eventually, she was able to be referred to other providers, but she had a very, very bad time with the last one. She arrived at the office of the new neurologist. There was no receptionist or nurse. She walked down a long, dark hallway and opened the door and found a man sitting at his desk. He never got up or looked away from his computer. He spent the 10-minute visit opening his mail. He didn't examine her and asked her only two questions, whether she could touch her nose with her finger and whether she had any medical problems. He prescribed drugs that immediately made her dizzy. Her primary care doc told her not to take them eventually, and now she's seeking a new referral. So you can just see the sort of the cascading problems that arise when these kinds of things are the result of being mandatorily enrolled in a plan that really doesn't have the capacity to deal appropriately with the needs of the beneficiary. So what are the lessons learned? Well, the implementation process did not provide beneficiaries with sufficient time or information to make an informed choice about the plans. In some cases, there were more than one plan choice, but if you weren't informed about what those choices were, then you were not going to be making a good decision. Many beneficiaries lost long-standing relationships with their providers, as we just looked at these two examples, and there have been disruptions in care, changes in treatment. The improvements that are obviously needed in this process include providing appropriate resources for the enrollment process. It's better education, better outreach to beneficiaries, culturally relevant, usable, understandable materials, including materials in alternative formats such as Braille and audio, and education and oversight regarding the managed care system, which we talked about at some point, obviously necessary. It's important to develop an administrative data infrastructure that's going to support the transition and support the beneficiaries that's still in the process of being developed and not adequate at this time. It's necessary to set clear and uniform quality benchmarks and manage risk and set accurate payment rates to the extent possible. So I'm going to stop at that point and ask the song to you.
Thanks, Marisa. So June's going to provide us with a brief...